The Guardian.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The wheels come off Manchester City as Pep is finally exposed as Liverpool hit four. Arsenal didn't have any wheels in the first place, but they have a miserable weekend, losing to Bournemouth and looking like losing Alexis Sanchez to Manchester United. Manager news, give it Giggsy to the end of the season. Wales go further, it's a four-year deal for him. While breaking news, Paul Lambert gets the Stoke job. In Spain, Sid will tell us about a Barca comeback, a glorious Luis Suarez goal and another defeat for Real Madrid. And most importantly, we ask if refs should be able to kick people and find out which ex-professional goalkeeper eats frozen kebabs and which current Premier League manager eats worms. All that in today's Guardian Football Weekly. So, how to introduce the panel today? Let's see if everyone's with me. We've got Barry. And Sachin Nacrani. Wilson and Sid Lowe.
I've got no idea what you're doing. What
but
is this?
There's no Jimbo. Have you not heard this Mo Salah song that's gone viral, Wilson?
No.
Do you not have a computer or any access to social media?
You can see my computer. Like, you can see me looking.
Can I just say really quickly, I saw that guy outside Anfield yesterday taking pictures with punters by the Texaco petrol station outside the cop. So that sort of shows celebrity status he's taken on now in quite a short space of time.
But the Liverpool fans, did they embrace it? Because I thought they played it on the tannoy.
Well, it was an actual chant. It's not one I'm that familiar with. It's an actual chant, and he's just given his own take on it. Which in a way has ruined the song now, because there's a lot of Liverpool fans who don't like him. They think he's a bit of a clown. He thinks he makes the club a little bit of a laughing stock, and more of a laughing stock than he perhaps is, as some people might say. And so now he's basically ruined the chant, because you can't sing the song inside the ground now, because it feels like it's an approval of his take on it. So he's ruined the song by making it go viral.
And now I've written a new version.
Yeah. But your version's better, I'd suggest.
Okay.
I still have no idea what's going on.
So there's a song and it went viral and everyone seemed happy about it until someone wasn't happy about it. Like most things that go viral, you know.
Yeah. I'll show you later.
Yeah.
That's fine, don't worry. Okay.
Well, Greg Bukowski has mentioned before there seems to be a very strict fan hierarchy at Anfield, and you know, certain fans don't like certain other fans, and you sing this song on particular days,
yeah,
and
yeah,
it seems a real minefield on what should be, you know, a pretty enjoyable day out.
Yeah, interestingly though,
a pretty enjoyable day out for like-minded individuals who all seem to hate each other.
But the Liverpool fans, I noticed, and we will get to the game, are very good at shouting "man on," almost better than any other set of supporters. Well, I saw that a few times when, you know, Liverpool player would get the ball in a tight position and it would be the crowd in unison shouting "man on." So maybe they sing their songs separately, but they come together for tactical chants that will help the players.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the game? You were there then, Sachin.
I was, yeah.
You are a Liverpool fan. You must have had a lovely time.
Not as much as I should have done. I was saying to you before we started, it was really weird when the final whistle blew. I felt a little bit flat, despite the fact just seeing Liverpool beat the best team in the country in a probably the game of the season. But I think, was it with 80-odd minutes, it was 4-1. You're standing there thinking, you know, we're going to spank the best team in the country. And then when the final whistle blew, it was relief more than anything. I was quite drained. Those last few minutes were, I think it's a game for the neutrals, as a cliche goes. But as a fan, it was quite hard. But I think having sort of, you know, a few hours on, having slept on it, yeah, definitely. I mean, it was a brilliant game. It was great to see Liverpool play that well. I think I saw a stat, apologies, I can't remember who it came from, but they put out that Liverpool outran City and let me get this right, and they covered, in terms of most distance per game, they beat their season average by 6 kilometres. So essentially what happened was Liverpool outworked City, and that was evident watching the game. I'm sure it was on TV as well, and that is, I'm sure Jonathan can talk better about, is basically the fundamental guiding principle of Klopp. It's what he did at Mainz, it's what he did at Dortmund. He thinks you can beat better teams, more tactically aware teams, by basically working harder than them. I think Sebastian Kehl, his first captain Dortmund, has said about working under Klopp is about, you know, a willingness to run and tolerate pain. And you saw that at Liverpool. And I think players like Andrew Robertson is the epitome of that. He's the type of player that will thrive under Klopp because he's willing to work hard. And it's the reason why someone like, for instance, Daniel Sturridge won't, because, and I don't get the whole Daniel Sturridge lazy thing, because I think in itself that's a lazy kind of stereotype, but he just hasn't got that energy that a Klopp team needs. And I think what Klopp's doing at Liverpool now, which again he did at Dortmund and did at Mainz, is he's moulding a team into his image, as opposed to bending for the players around him. And this feels for me now like a real Jurgen Klopp team, and it's thrilling to watch.
They just wanted it more.
I mean, I think Klopp has actually slightly stepped back from him. I mean, clearly, you know, they did run themselves on the ground, and Robertson particularly, yeah. You know, when he was closing down Edison with, I don't know, what, 10 or 15 minutes ago, that incident where he just kind of just kept going. But I think where Liverpool this season are more impressive than they have been is the discipline of the press. So it's not just sort of headless chicken charging. I don't think it was at Dortmund either, but I think it is a sort of sophisticated, refined process. So if you look at the third Liverpool goal, I think that's a great example of it. So John Stones has the ball. So he basically gets the ball from the kickoff. So it's a pretty sort of static... static is the right word. It's almost a sort of set piece. It's something you can plan for. So Stones has the ball. He's got Otamendi to his left. He's got the two fullbacks sort of slightly advanced. And Firmino goes to within, I guess, 5-6 yards of him. And he's just sort of hovering. And then the passing lane out of the two fullbacks, Salah is blocking one and Mane is blocking the other. And there's a moment of hesitation from Stones. And Firmino then goes. Everybody sees that moment of hesitation. Firmino goes to him, forcing the little nervy short pass to Otamendi, at which Salah cuts in from the side where to stop him preventing playing that ball out to the left. And Oxlade-Chamberlain springs beyond Fernandinho, and suddenly Otamendi's got nowhere to go. Salah turned out to be one who wins the ball, and Mane's come into that gap between the fullback and Stones. So it's a simple pass to him, but also he was blocking the pass. So it's positionally, I guess it's kind of not that difficult. It's an obvious thing to do, but it's the timing of it, the recognition of the trigger. And that, I think, is now what marks out the best pressing teams from the ones who just charge at people and work very hard. But Liverpool have working very hard and the discipline. And Klopp was clearly delighted with that, because his press conference afterwards, he said our pressing today was out of this world. So even by his standards, he saw that as being... exceptional.
Did you see? He was very happy. Did you see his press conference for US TV? Have you got that to play, Jonathan?
This is
we're live to the NBC. States,
yeah.
NBC.
That means my boss is watching it for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Jumping up and down. So you can watch, have a look at this game in different ways. You can look at it as a manager and say, okay, we could have done this and that better. Or you have a look at it as a football fan and say, what the fuck was that? They were unbelievable, though.
We just apologise for that.
I thought America it's okay. In England, it's
yeah, you can't say that on the television, Jürgen. But he was very excited. Barry Gareth says, "Are Man City in crisis?"
Clearly, they've now lost two of their past 40 Premier League games, and if the crisis klaxon isn't honking loud over the Etihad, I don't know when it will. Obviously, I'm being facetious. I don't think they're in crisis. I was shocked by that result. Actually, I thought before the game that they would win fairly comfortably, to be honest. And even during the game, even at 2-1, I thought Liverpool will tire and Manchester City will, you know, sucker them with a couple of late goals as they have so many other teams. But that just didn't happen. And I suppose that's down to Liverpool's superior levels of fitness. But I think it's a bit curmudgeonly just to attribute this win to fitness and excellent pressing, you know, when there was so much more on show as well, because it's just Liverpool clicked everything. You know, everyone played brilliantly, apart from perhaps Karius, who there's clearly a goalkeeping problem at Liverpool and they need a new keeper, but Andrew Robertson, superb. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain was outstanding. The front three, brilliant. And there's no disgrace in losing for City. I think it was always a tall order, going to be a tall order for them to get through the season unbeaten, but it's how they bounce back from it, I suppose.
Is it a ridiculous comment to say, is it good that City have lost a game because now they don't have to think about whether they're going to lose a game, they can just go and relax and win the league?
I think deep down they said they weren't thinking about it. I think they must have thought, we can do this. We can do this undefeated season. So I think it is a bit of a blow for them because they're over the halfway mark. This was probably their last truly difficult game. Obviously, there's always hurdles in the way. There's always difficult games. They've still got what, Chelsea to come at the Etihad, and they're probably going to go to, I think,
Spurs at Wembley.
Spurs away, yeah. So there are tough games, but this was arguably the hardest. So I do think, whatever they say, they're probably a little bit disappointed. But I just got to say, I mean, I know there was it's a facetious tweet, whatever it is, about being in crisis. I actually think they could take so many positives out of yesterday. I thought they were outstanding. I mean, they had 65% possession, so they still dominated the ball. And just watching them in the flesh, they're such, I know it's an obvious thing to say, they're such a good football team. And Kevin De Bruyne, I mean, he was getting harassed and hassled by Emre Can in particular, and still sort of just got away from him. And I think what I was really impressed with De Bruyne yesterday is he's got great skill, but he's just showed such strength and desire. He was barging players out of the way, getting through the lines. He's just a brilliant, brilliant footballer. And I think City can take, and a lot of positives, the way they sort of fought at the end as well, maybe for the Champions League, that will give him a lot of heart as well. So they can take a lot of positives out yesterday, I thought.
The one thing I would... I mean, it's obviously not a crisis. I mean, clearly it's a million miles from being a crisis. However... since I think they went to sleep in that Newcastle game and they haven't quite woken up yet, City. And you know, it's a measure of just how good they've been this season that we can say that when they've dropped 4 points since that Newcastle game. But they weren't great in beating Burnley in the FA Cup. You know, for 4-1 sort of flattered them a little bit, and Burnley had them under pressure at times. Bristol City they weren't great against. The draw against Palace, obviously, and then losing yesterday. But then you think about it and you think, well, you know, as we've said, everything clicked for Liverpool. All four goals were absolutely brilliant finishes, and they still only won 4-3. Mm. So I think it's nothing like a crisis, but they have slightly tailed off, I think, in the last month. Slightly. A tiny bit.
If Liverpool hadn't won that game, a lot of this pod would be discussing Karius and the goalkeeping situation. But Sane did kick that ball really quite hard. You know, I know goalkeepers should never, ever be beaten at their near post. It's the worst thing any human being can do in life, let alone a goalkeeper could do on the pitch. But I did feel for him a bit. Did you not, Baz?
Well, by all accounts, he was told before the game, if you play well today, the goalkeeping position is yours. You are my number one guy. And that's quite a lot of pressure to put someone under. And you have to say he kind of wilted under that pressure, you know. Now, as you say, the finishing was outstanding. The shot was hard, but it's his job to stop it. And he didn't. And he should have. So, you know.
I'm with you, Ian, Max. I think that's... there's three mistakes. There's three things that aren't great from Liverpool in that goal. You have the Gomez getting defeated by the flight of the ball, Matip being beaten by a little drop of the shoulder. But then that's so quick going past Matip that Karius must have been expecting Sane to go inside. He must have been expecting the other way. He's got to reset. And then suddenly, before he's had a chance to sort of to get himself ready, the ball's been hit incredibly hard past him. I know David Priest was talking on Twitter about this hand position that, and it's interesting David Priest goes on about, I have to say, I don't entirely understand it, about starting position of hands. He doesn't like low hands, and he thought that Karius got stuck between two positions. But the ball was hit incredibly hard, and maybe he could have been 6 inches further to his right.
I just think sometimes, it was Gary Neville, I think it was on commentary, it's so easy to say the goalkeeper's at fault, when actually...
Never found it easy to say when Joe Hart is at fault, so I would have to disagree with him there.
That Arsenal goal recently that Wilshere scored, I've got a sense I was at the game.
Is that Chelsea?
Against Chelsea, yeah.
Top left-hand corner.
Yeah, and that was another goal at the near post. It was hit incredibly hard. And I was the near post.
Was unstoppable.
Blokes absolutely thrashed it, and it's got... Well, that one, I think, hit the post on the way in. The Sane one was an inch, 2 inches inside the post. I don't know, I think.
Just over.
There's been beaten in the near post and there's been beaten in the near post. You know,
yeah, I agree with that. City had four shots on target yesterday. Three of them went in. I mean, I was surprised there was one that didn't, basically, because just watching Karius, I genuinely left the game yesterday. I didn't remember him making a save. And I agree that, you know, that shot from Sane, I mean, it was vicious and it was really hard. But watching the replay, and okay, Jonathan's point is totally valid that he had to reset himself. It was difficult. But even if he's just got his body across, he would have stopped it. I mean, it just went through a gap, I think, that shouldn't have been there. And, I mean, this goalkeeper situation is just maddening, to be honest. you shouldn't be rotating your goalkeepers for a start. I think it's a really bad sign. Whatever Klopp says, he shouldn't be doing it. And he's done phenomenal things at Liverpool, but for me, this remains his blind spot. He needs to get on top of this really quickly.
All right, well, let's move on to a game that Jack Wilshere was in. Speaking of his near post finish, he played quite well, but Arsenal lost to Bournemouth. This was a weird game, Barry, because Arsenal 1-0 up and they were just so comfortable and there was no way they weren't going to win this game except they are Arsenal.
I would disagree that they look comfortable.
Okay.
I didn't think they looked particularly comfortable at all. And because they're so brittle, I think when they're 1-0 up against a team like Bournemouth or anyone else, that team are always going to fancy themselves to get a goal back, you know, and perhaps, you know, at least get a draw or go on to win the game. And that's exactly what happened here. Arsenal were awful. Really, really terrible. Wilshere aside, looking at the anger of Arsenal fans on social media, you know, Arsblog in particular, is just at the end of his tether, you know. But I find it difficult. I wonder where he gets these reserves of anger. Like, say, Jonathan and I, Sunderland fans, it's weary resignation at this stage. I don't expect any better. And I'm kind of half interested to see how much gas is in the Sunderland explosion. I think there could be a lot more.
You get to a point where you just want to keep going down. Like, how bad can this get?
Yeah, exactly.
The expectations are different. They are different. They can't.
Why?
Well, my expectations are low.
Yeah.
But at the best of times, but now I'm just kind of...
I mean, they're only different because of the last 80 years of history.
But
Arsenal's away record.
You know, sorry, the thing with Arsenal is their owner and, you know, the people who own the club or the majority shareholders don't care about performances on the pitch. They don't care if Arsenal win the league. They're not that bothered if Arsenal don't challenge for Champions League places, as long as the money keeps rolling in. And the money at the moment is rolling in. They're making fortunes, and what their interests and the fans' interests are completely different. That's not going to change anytime soon.
Well, I think it might change, because I think they're now getting into a situation where they're going to take a financial hit.
How? I mean, they will eventually, but not quite yet. I don't think they're anywhere near an emergency situation.
I think they're not far off, actually. You know, failing to get in the Champions League repeatedly becomes an issue. It makes it much harder to justify season ticket prices. You're going to get less money from broadcast rights, television income. Ken Early made the point last week, and I sort of, when I first heard it, I was like, yeah, he's exaggerated there, saying that Arsenal now are in a worse state than they were when Wenger took over. Then I looked at the squad that Wenger took over, and he had David Seaman, he had the famous back four, he had Bergkamp and Wright. And you look at this side and you think, okay, Sanchez goes, Ozil goes, Wilshere's out of contract. What's the legacy? What's there for maybe to take over? You get Koscielny, who's got a permanently crocked Achilles. Oh, hang on, that's it. This is... What is it?
You've got Rob Holding.
You've got, Mustafi, Xhaka and Lacazette, who's looked completely sort of bewildered in the Premier League so far.
To be fair to Lacazette, I think it's kind of unfair to blame him.
I'm not blaming him, but I'm just...
The service he's getting is appalling.
Even when he was signed, I thought, is he really the right sort of player for the football that Arsenal play? I think, I'm not sure he contributes a huge amount outside the box. And so if you're going to use him, you need to be getting service into him, and he's not getting that service. It's not a question of blaming Lacazette, but whoever takes over from Wenger is going to have this squad with very little.
Do you think anyone ever will take over? I mean, Arsenal View asks, if you were going to hire a new manager for Arsenal today based on availability, who would it be asking for a CEO friend? But I don't, I just, it's the constants in life. Like, Arsene Wenger's going to be there next year.
A question I'd love to ask Arsene Wenger, he's obviously an Arsenal fan, so it goes without saying. As an Arsenal fan, does he not think Arsenal need a new manager? If he just takes himself out of the position of being a manager, if he was like in the stands, I don't think Arsene Wenger would ever go in the stands, does he not think Arsenal need a new manager? I mean, talking about fans, Arsenal fans on social media. Just if I could read a tweet from Tim Stillman, who's quite a prominent Arsenal blogger and goes Home and Away, which for me sums up the situation where Arsenal are in now, where he wrote straight after the game yesterday, "Hope, no matter how misplaced or naive, is a huge part of being a fan, and it is impossible to have any while Arsenal are in the thrall to Arsene Wenger's fear of retirement."
It's not part of being a Sunderland fan, I don't recognise that at all.
But that absolutely nails it for me, because the sort of tragedy of this great long goodbye is, just as an Arsenal fan, you have no hope. As a fan, when managers come and go, it just gives you a re-energy. Barry's laughing. It just gives you sort of fresh hope. A new manager, even if you're slightly dubious about his...
We've had 9 managers in the last 9 years, and none of them's got
But don't you think every time a new manager comes in, at least you go, right, this could be a little bit different, a little bit interesting, something might happen? You can't have that as an Arsenal fan. It's the same cycle going around over and over again.
Just to pick
Simon
you up,
Grayson, sorry. Paul Grayson will be here. Larry Grayson, anybody.
Larry Grayson with Isla Sinclair as his number 2.
Just to pick you
Why
up.
Why not?
Hey, there was a time
well,
when
he's dead, but apparently. He'd
still do a better job that weekend at Bernie's. He can take over Arsenal on a golf cart. There was a time when Cambridge, bottom of League Two, hired Claude Lelouch and Herve Renard. And literally, you're just... I mean, it was absolutely magnificent. You had hope. It was the worst possible. I mean, their knowledge of League Two was not great. They'd just come from, I think, the Ivory Coast. I'm not sure. It's just not... It's just not... Just,
and that must have been really exciting. But it must have been great.
Well, it was exciting because they just looked... They looked unlike every fat, bald manager we'd had exactly. for the last, like, 30 years.
But it's something, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right. Something. It is something. To be fair, Arsene Wenger does go in the stands when he has a stadium ban.
Of course, yeah.
Often stands next to somebody who works in his house, but he's never met.
I think I was at a game. Game under Lelouch. Did Cambridge maybe lose 2-1 at home to Oxford under Lelouch?
We probably did.
And the thing I remember...
Did we have Lionel Perez? So we spent all our wages on Lionel Perez, right? And then after... And he was such a hero, but he got lobbed because he was quite often on the halfway line. Yeah. And then there was one... The last game of the season, we'd already got relegated from League Two. And then the then manager, John Taylor, we got a penalty. Said, oh, sod it, go on. And Lionel went up to take the penalty, right? So we were that sort of like, "It's everything's gone now. We can be ridiculous." And he took the penalty, hit it so hard it hit the opposition goalkeeper and broke his ankle and went over the bar. So then we had 10 minutes of their keeper lying in a heap on the line. Anyway,
but I think it was Lelouch, that the pitch wasn't sort of central on the bit of grass, and so he was after the game, he was pacing it out.
I don't know.
I think that was Lelouch.
Anyway, we've gone slightly off topic.
Yeah, sorry. What was the topic?
Alexis Sanchez didn't play. Is he off to Manchester United? Does anyone know anything? It seems that's the most likely destination for him now, which I must admit, I'm amazed about that. But maybe I'm wrong to be amazed.
Well, Jamie Jackson, the Guardian's man in the Rennie hat on the Manchester beat, said this morning, today being Monday, that... Manchester City aren't prepared to meet Sanchez's wage demands, and his agent wants a massive whack on top of any transfer fee, which they also don't want to pay, just, I think, out of principle. And Manchester United apparently are prepared to pay these or to meet these terms, so it is to Manchester that he looks likely to head, because City have more or less resigned themselves to not getting him.
Amateur Lobster says, how exactly would Alexis be used by Mourinho if he moves to United? And the first response was, fullback.
I'm baffled by City's reluctance to spend whatever the extra is.
They're very principled club, Jonathan.
But, yeah, for the sake of 5 million, 10 million, 15 million, whatever, how are they going to get a player as good as Sanchez in the summer for... less than sort of 100, 120. The fact Sanchez is available and cheap, surely that legitimises paying a little bit extra. And also, surely the concern of him being just across town and helping your main rivals. I'm now thinking that I might have got confused. It might have actually been Ramon Diaz when he was at Oxford.
Hey, that's fine. It was a good enough anecdote.
That was also a bizarre appointment. Ramon Diaz, former Argentina striker, going to Oxford.
As I said, Alexis Sanchez. Sachin, thoughts?
Yeah, it is a strange one. I mean, the other way I look at this, if I can just hammer Arsene Wenger a bit more, is maybe Sanchez is so determined to get out of Arsenal as quickly as possible. He can see the buildings on fire and he just wants to save himself.
Because people are saying he's after the money, but if he waited until the end of the season, he'd get a bucket load more money,
yeah,
wouldn't he?
So, and he's probably so desperate and he's probably so fearful that City won't take him in the summer because they might end up getting, I don't know, Neymar or something. And and United are bowing to every need. He's like, sod it, I'll just go there. I've got to get out of Arsenal. It's such a terrible club. And also from Arsenal's point of view, I think this is just such a damning loss of a play. By now, they should be on level par with Manchester United in terms of financial strength and ability to win major trophies in this post-Fergie era, and all the money Arsenal should have now having paid off the stadium, and the fact that following Robin van Persie they're losing another striker to Man United, I just think is utterly damning. But yeah, sort of agree, it's slightly strange that City aren't paying the money to get him. He's obviously a brilliant footballer.
We should say well done to Bournemouth. They did play in that match against Arsenal. and Callum Wilson had a good game. Ryan Fraser, lovely cross for Wilson's goal.
Well, interesting actually, Ryan Fraser was largely responsible for the fact that Arsenal went 3-0 down against Bournemouth in the corresponding fixture last season. He had another blinder as well. It's a small thing, but it's just indicative of Arsenal's inability to learn, you know, from their mistakes. And Ryan Fraser, while a decent player, he's no world beater, you know. They should be able to contain him, but they couldn't. And there was a comical moment in that game where I think it was for Callum Wilson's goal, where Ryan Fraser got the ball down the right wing, there's four Arsenal players hairing towards him, you know, like, I don't know, dogs running, chasing a tennis ball, and none of them got to him. He got in the cross, and Petr Cech, which is another weak link in the Arsenal, one of many Arsenal weak links, was too indecisive or too slow off his line and was beaten to the ball by Wilson.
Do you want some breaking news, everybody? Because Manchester United play Stoke today. We were going to discuss how nobody wanted the Stoke job, but Paul Lambert does, and he's got it. And on the Stoke City website, welcome Paul, it said, quote, arguably his greatest managerial achievement was keeping Aston Villa in the Premier League against all expectations in difficult circumstances.
Dig. That's a bit of a dig at Villa, isn't it?
He's a man who backed himself as a player, none more so than when he turned down contract offers in Scotland to go on trial in the German Bundesliga with Borussia Dortmund. And it's obvious he adopts the same approach as manager. He has been successful in management at clubs with a strong and stable background and with local ownership, the kind of foundation we're able to give our managers.
Didn't he get promoted 2 seasons in a row with Norwich? Isn't that better than keeping Villa up?
That's what I was thinking. I was like, surely that's better than keeping Villa in the Premier
League. It wasn't two in a row. It was definitely two in three seasons.
No, it was two on the bounce. I'm sure it was.
Well,
did they say in that welcome Paul message that he was their third choice?
It doesn't. Peter Coates said, Paul greatly impressed us with his knowledge of our squad and had a clear plan of how he would improve our results. So he'll watch from the stands at Old Trafford tonight. No place does it say they really wanted. Yes, it says here, we really wanted Gary Rowett or Kike Sanchez-Flores
or Martin O'Neill,
but none of them wanted to come because the squad's not good enough. We might go down. Yeah, so that is a quote at the bottom of the piece. Any thoughts? I've met Paul Lambert. He's a really nice man, and I really, really hope he does well.
Yeah, he was treated very shabbily at Villa, I think, as far as I can remember.
His record at Villa, that's the only club where he had lower than 40% win ratio.
Right.
And I seem to remember his football being utterly dismal and defensive to the point of passivity.
That's the kind of boost he'll need for the game, isn't it?
But elsewhere,
he saved Villa, didn't he?
Incredible job at Norwich, as you say, back-to-back promotions.
Did well at Colchester before he jumped ship.
Won the European Cup with Borussia Dortmund. I know that was as a player, but still pretty good achievement, I'd say.
I've now looked up that Cambridge-Oxford match report.
Oh, good, good.
It was
the
26th of February 2005. It was Ramon Diaz.
Okay.
Do you know who Cambridge manager was at the time?
John Taylor.
Steve Thompson.
Couldn't even pick him out of a crowd of one.
So it said he couldn't win a one-ticket raffle, was a quote from him. Cambridge were a month from administration. They had to raise £300,000 by the end of February.
Oh.
And they looked like being bought out by something called Dr. Johnny Hon. Do you remember?
Yes, I remember rumours of Johnny Hon. We also were at one point rumoured to be taken over by Jason Donovan. That got very exciting. And Bill Gates, because obviously Cambridge has the Silicon Fen.
Dr. Johnny Hon was a venture capitalist for the second largest shareholding in the club. He has a PhD in psychiatry from Cambridge University.
Jonathan, has James Richardson given you money to try and single-handedly ruin the podcast he left behind by constantly bringing up this match?
No, he was involved in banking and financial consultancy in Anjouan, an independent island in the Indian Ocean that's since become destabilised. He's also met with Kim Jong-il, the North Korean head of state, purportedly to discuss investment in his country. Obviously, Dr. Hon's been involved in some strange things, said Jordan. Who's Jordan?
Producer Jonathan says...
Martin Jordan of Cambridge Fans United.
Producer Jonathan says, we've been on for half an hour and we've done two games.
Sorry, that's it.
Well, three.
Yes. Sorry, I'll change the intro to say we'll go big on Cambridge's 2-1 defeat to Oxford in 2005.
They won.
Oh, yeah. Thank the Lord for that. Barry, you have a good Stoke stat, don't you?
Yeah, the Stoke play Manchester United Monday night. Mm. In 8 Monday night games they've played since the Premier League started, Stoke have never been beaten.
On a Monday night?
Never been beaten.
Interesting. Saida Berahino turned up in his tracksuit yesterday, 24 hours early for the game. Kurt Zouma sent a video saying, "Oh, you've turned up early."
Saida Berahino. Saida Berahino turning up in a tracksuit, to be honest.
It was in Stoke, the official Stoke tracksuit. Saida Berahino has rejected these claims and said, "As if I would turn up early." And then he says, quote, "Fail to prepare, prepare to fail."
Is he in any way related to the Saido Berahino who has not yet scored for Stoke and
sure.
played well over 2,000 minutes of football since he last scored a goal?
Tonight could be the night. Spurs 4, Everton 0. 2 more for Harry Kane. Now Spurs' record ever goal scorer in the Premier League when football began. 98, beating Teddy Sheringham's record. Jimmy Greaves' record is 266. Steve writes, with another double for Harry Kane this weekend, is he now on for the most goals in the Chinese and Mayan calendar year? Which hopefully he is. But should we praise Son Heung-min instead, Sachin? Because
he's
a marvellous footballer.
I adore Son. He's genuinely one of my favourite footballers. Every time I watch him play, he seems to be great. He's like the sort of the opposite of Zlatan Ibrahimovic back in the day, when every time I watched him play, he didn't do very well. But I was at Wembley. I covered the game for The Observer, and I thought Son was absolutely outstanding. I would say, arguably at the moment, he's Tottenham's second most important attacking player, above Eriksen and Ali, which I know is a bit of a wild shout. But I just think he gives them a pace, a sort of an injection of pace that they lack in the team. They've got a lot of great qualities, but they're not the quickest of teams. And I think he gives them that great movement. And he's getting goals now. He's always got 8 this season, which is second highest score in the Premier League. Pochettino said after the game, he's playing with a great level of maturity. I do think he's massively underrated. I think he's a really, really good footballer. And he was outstanding on Saturday.
My favourite part of his performance, and it was just an outstanding performance from start to finish, was when he took the ball or received the ball to tee up Harry Kane for, I think, Spurs second, and he just this spin that stitched up, I think it was John Joe Kenny.
John Joe Kenny's still there.
Yeah, isn't he? It was just remarkable. Just the execution, the idea, and it was amazing. He's a wonderful player. I mean, there was a time not too long ago that everyone thought he'd be out. You know, he there wouldn't be a place for him in the Spurs team, but He's so important.
And that Eriksen goal was beautiful. So just one touch. Was it Aurier, Son, Ali, Eriksen was beautiful. Yeah. Big Sam says, I think Everton need to be a bit more boring.
Good God, that would be... just how? Is it possible for Everton to be more
boring? What's incredible about that statement is it came after their third game out of 6 where Everton didn't have a shot on target. I mean, I find that absolutely staggering. Can you imagine not making the opposition goalkeeper work in 3 out of your previous 6 games? I mean, he said that... He gave this... say the Sunderland fans. But he says that, you know, he said after the game, we were too adventurous. I mean, they were attacking players on the pitch, but they didn't actually attack. I thought they were incredibly flat and demoralised. And I mean, I think a moment for me that summed up just their lack of fight, their lack of interest, was Gylfie Sigurdsson's attempt to stop Eric Dier's cross for Harry Kane's second goal. If you watch it again, he sort of wafts his right leg at it with no passion or interest at all. I mean, Everton are just an absolute mess of a football team.
Jonathan's thinking a shot on target every other game is actually not too bad, isn't it? Chelsea 0, Leicester 0. 3 consecutive 0-0 draws for the first time in Chelsea's history. Leicester with the better team. Dom Fifield wrote, Chelsea have become too predictable, too over-reliant on Hazard.
Well, yeah, that's completely true. I don't understand what... I mean, Ian Wright was making this point in the match of the day, so I sort of... But I had thought it first. I don't understand why against a team like Leicester, where you would expect to have the bulk of game. Yeah, if you're Chelsea, you'd expect to beat Leicester. Why is he playing that system with the three deep-lying central midfielders? And, you know, I know Bakayoko and Fabregas are supposed to be getting forward, but why has he changed from the 3-4-2-1 with Hazard alongside Pedro or Willian? I get why you might do that against Tottenham away, for instance, or Manchester City at home, but why are you doing it for sort of ordinary games? I don't really understand. I mean, that seems to cause the over-reliance on Hazard because he's the only player in that half of the pitch. So, I mean, that's down to Conte, and I don't really get what he's trying to do there.
I think maybe also when you have a player who's as good as Hazard is and sort of head and shoulders above everyone else on the team in current form anyway, it's easy to become over-reliant on them because they're so good and they're consistently delivered. Delivers, you get them the ball, and then when Hazard doesn't play well, as he didn't against Leicester, then where you don't have a plan B because you're so reliant on plan A.
But Hazard's gone off last three games he started, I think, maybe even more than that.
Yeah, his form isn't as good now as I meant his form sort of.
Yeah, no, sure,
but
I mean,
they've
become over reliant on him, and he's not playing that well.
Yeah.
So again, why? Why create a situation where everything creative has to go through him when he's not even in a good moment?
That's a good point. That's what I'm asking. You know, is it just there's an absence of plan B there? There seems to be.
Yeah, and yet in a squad that Conte's complained about not being big enough, he has two very obvious plan Bs in Willian and Pedro. And
15 starts, been subbed 10 times.
Right.
There you go. Who's going to get top four, Sachin, then? It's quite exciting now, isn't it? If you find getting top four exciting, which we all sort of... That's become a thing.
It is a thing, yeah. It's a trophy, I believe, or something. What said. Well, obviously, City are nailed on. I think United will get in there, certainly if they sign Sanchez. The way Liverpool are playing, I think they should make it as well. I think, talking about Chelsea, there is a flatness there, and it could ultimately cost them. Just look at the league table. I mean, Tottenham are only 3 points off, and I'd suggest, well, I'm not suggesting it's the fact they're in better form than Chelsea at the moment. So if I had to say now, I'd say City first, Liverpool second, Man United third, Tottenham fourth.
I think... Chelsea will miss out and Arsenal as well.
Agreed?
Not entirely. I mean, Arsenal will miss out, obviously. I think it's really any three from four. Okay. I feel unable to pick. I mean, Tottenham are 3 points behind, which is not completely insignificant with only 15 games to go.
And Tottenham are going to go to Chelsea as well, so that's obviously a very tough game. They really wouldn't have.
Well, we'll only replay that if it turns out to be right, and if not, pretend we never did it. Right, that'll do for part one. We'll be back with part two. Josh writes, quote, "It mildly annoys me when you say welcome back to part two, because we haven't been to part two yet. How are we coming back to part two? It makes a very good point. And maybe we should abandon parts altogether and just say back in a sec and do the little advert and then just be back."
Now, people like to know where they are, don't they?
Okay, so we're in part two.
If you doodled a penis on your bit of paper there.
No.
What is it?
Is it a big top hat, Barry?
Well, it started as a cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
It
looks like a whistle from here. Mm. Is that a whistle?
And... yeah, that.
We just
coloured
in the end now. It doesn't help. If anything, that's better.
Anyway, let's start at the bottom and work up. Everyone from Swansea. Does anyone agree with this? From Swansea at the bottom to Everton, who are ninth on 27 points, they could all go down.
Yes.
I'd be amazed if Everton did, but yes, they could.
Yeah, the same. So look, we'll start Newcastle.
Well, sorry, no, they couldn't all go down.
No, they couldn't.
Three of them could go down.
That's a very good point. Thanks.
I don't think it would be any great loss if they all went down.
And even if they did, Sunderland aren't anywhere near the promotion picture.
You'll enjoy League One and we'll get to that. Newcastle won, Swansea won, which was not a fascinating football match. Has anyone seen a bit more life in Swansea since Carlos Carvalhal?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely is, isn't it? Yeah, they come back against Watford and they've sort of... I mean, they don't look completely doomed now. They're obviously not in a great position, but I think there's a glimmer of hope where there was no hope before. So, yeah.
I'm also a fan of a centre-forward who looks surprised when they score. And that's what Joselu, when the ball went in, he did look genuinely quite shocked that he'd scored a goal. Is it just me, or does he look like the policeman from Hello, Hello?
Oh,
trying to picture the policeman from Hello, Hello.
Looks like Joselu.
Yeah, but like more of a uniform and sort of one of those little cylindrical.
He looks the most like the policeman from Hello, Hello since Philippe Albert.
Oh, Philippe Albert definitely looked like the policeman from Alone.
So how did you remember the policeman looks like? Yeah, when now, you didn't before, but now you do. I mentioned Philippe Albert.
Yeah, I've just got him in my head, and then I've seen Philippe Albert at the same time, and yeah, they definitely.
Do you think his name's actually Jocelyn, or is it just a crazy pronunciation, much more ordinary word?
Jeff.
Well, because you know, the policeman from Alone.
Oh, I see. Right, I understand. <Fucking
hell. laughs> Keep up somewhere.
Anyway, back to that Cambridge Oxford game. West Brom beat Brighton 2-0. West Brom are 19th, 19 points. That's their first win in 20 or 21. They'd won the first two games of the season. Two goals from set pieces, very Pulis-like for West Brom, Barry.
Yeah, Johnny Evans and Craig Dawson with the goals from corners. So I think West Brom fans were hoping to get away from that Pulis kind of thing. They can't really afford to be picky at the moment, so they'll take that much-needed win, because I think it was certainly the first Premier League win since
the second game of the season,
took over. Yeah. Brighton, perhaps unlucky to not get a penalty for the... West Brom should have had a penalty as well for the Glenn Murray handball. And Brighton, actually, weird as a stat, I think it was a match of the day. Brighton have conceded 16 goals from set pieces this season so far, which is quite a lot, and possibly the most of any team in the Premier League.
How good is Johnny Evans? He's constantly rumoured to be going to Arsenal or Manchester City, or one of the top sides.
I think he's really good. I mean, we had him on loan at Sunderland when he was just coming through, and he was excellent. You know, good on the ball, good defensively. It's obviously, you know, being good for Sunderland or being good for West Brom doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to be good for Manchester United, and there's obviously a reason why he left. But I can understand if you're a top four, top five club and you want somebody just to sort of fill in for 6 months till you make a big signing in the summer. You know, he's got Premier League experience. He clearly can pass a ball. He's clearly a decent player, so I can understand why he's in demand.
I think Van Gaal sold Johnny Evans, if I'm not mistaken. I think the word at the time was the players at United were absolutely shocked that he sold him. That they think he is a high. The players who were there at the time thought he was a really good defender, and there was absolutely no need to sell him. So I do think he's.
I mean, he had a tendency to sort of lapse the concentration. I think that was the one thing you'd say that he did make.
Which is why Sunderland got him.
He was great for us. He was really good. In my Sunderland team in the last decade, does he get? I think he probably gets in.
Who was the manager when he was at Sunderland? I can't remember.
That's a good question. No, it was under Roy Keane, because he played in the famous game against Cardiff. I keep on talking about it. He keeps getting cut now. I'm not going to bother again.
Is that the windy one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Jay Rodriguez and Gaten Bong.
Sorry, to go back to Evans, I think it's a measure of how good he is at Manchester City could have really done with him in that game against Liverpool, you know. I think if he went to City, he'd... I don't think it'd be sort of a reserve. I think he'd go straight into the team and stay in it.
Really? Well, ahead of Otamendi and Stones? I mean, I think he's better than Mangala, but is he better than Otamendi and Stones?
I think he's better than Otamendi, yeah. And I think he'd be good for Stones to have alongside as a kind of a...
And they could play a three then, I guess.
A steadying hand, or, you know... You clearly disagree.
I think Otamendi this season has been much, much better than he has been in the past. I think Otamendi's probably better in the air than Johnny Evans. And you'd say Evans is maybe a classier player, but Otamendi's completed more passes this season than anybody else in the Premier League. So that side of his game, I know most of them probably sort of 5 yards to the side to Stones, but... I think he would improve City's squad, certainly, because I think he's clearly better than Mangala, and Kompany clearly is never fit. But I'm not sure he'd displace Stone. You know, if Kompany's not there, Stones and Otamendi would be your first choice. Does Evans displace either of them? I wouldn't have necessarily thought so. But
I preferred if you told the windy story about Cardiff. Jay Rodriguez and Gaten Bong's Jay insulting Gaten Bong, and you could see clearly on the TV during the game that he was saying to the ref he was racist. Bong's been on French TV, I think it was last night, saying precisely that in a very eloquent way. It's very difficult in these cases when it's one person's word against another, isn't it?
I think the most don't know what the word is, the most damning aspect of that was that sniffing gesture that Rodriguez made as well, which I just thought looked really, really bad. And you do, I mean, as I said, these are all allegations, one word against another, but you do wonder why Bong would make something like that up as well. And as you said, I've seen the interview on French TV. He speaks really eloquently, really well, really measured.
So yeah. What did Bong say on French television?
He actually didn't make the allegation. He said, I'm not going to repeat on here what he said to me because of the language involved, but I think has he come out since, or has been reported since this morning what was said? I think that's
right. It's reported that that Rodriguez said, you're black and you stink.
Oh.
We don't know what happened. In the same way, we don't know what happened with Holgate and Firmino. We'll just have to wait and see what happens with the investigations into both those incidents. While we're on the subject of West Brom, really sad news this morning, the death of Cyril Regis, who passed away at the age of 59.
You know, when Johan Cruyff left Ajax as a manager, one of the causes was that Ajax wouldn't let him sign Cyril Regis to replace Marco van Basten.
You're joking.
Is that right? Yeah.
That's a story and a half.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was a great player, Cyril Regis.
I think he just won the FA Cup with Coventry. I think it was sort of 87, yeah. 8. So, I mean, he wasn't young then, was he, Regis? Regis must have been sort of late 20s. He was 59 when he died, so...
29-ish.
Mm. Yeah, 20s. So late 20s. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, that's how highly rated he was by Johan Cruyff. So I think maybe we remember him for what he meant as being one of the first high-profile black players, but actually appreciating what a good footballer he was.
Mm. The first game of the season, I went to Wickham away, and he must have been 36 or something, and he absolutely terrorised our defence and was brilliant, and we lost 3-0. But yeah, I think it's a very good point you make, Jonathan, about judging him not necessarily just as a footballer, and obviously he was a pioneer and one of the first black players, but yeah, great footballer.
There is a good article about him on the Set Pieces website. Two things took away from it. First, his name shouldn't have been Cyril. He's born in this rural town in French Guiana where his father was a gold prospector. And his father, when he was born, his father asked a friend of his who was going to the capital, French Guiana, which I don't know the name of, to register his son's birth. And told him, you know, Cyril or Gilbert Cyril Regis. So his friend got there, couldn't remember the entire name, so just registered him as Cyril Regis, hence the name. And
Cayenne is the capital of French.
Cayenne, yes, okay. And the other thing was when he was at West Brom as one of the three degrees, as they were called, him, Brendan Batson, and Laurie Cunningham. The three of them were at West Brom. Viv Anderson was at Nottingham Forest. And this is in the late 70s. They were the only four black players in the First Division. Seems astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, all sorts of tributes coming in. I think Andy Cole sent one just saying, you know, devastated this morning. My hero, my pioneer, the man behind the reason I wanted to play football has passed away. So, yeah, rest in peace, Cyril Regis. Tried it is to move on to the actual football. We mentioned Stoke already, who are 18th. Watford, Southampton. Southampton are 17th now. I think they haven't won in 10. Very unlucky in this game, aren't they? I mean, Barry, we must have VAR.
I don't think so. It was fairly obvious foul. I'm not sure how it was missed, but, you know, I thought Troy Deeney spoke well enough afterwards. He didn't try to pretend it was anything other than what it was and, you know, said if we had VAR, we wouldn't have got that. And it's just one of those things. We were lucky to get away with it. And I suppose you can get punished retrospectively for cheating up to a point, you know, diving in the box or trying to con the referee or whatever. Can you get punished retrospectively for deliberately handling the ball into the net and...
Well, you should.
Getting the goal and not... Well,
I think it's actually a way of getting more decisions correct without the need for VAR, which, you know, as has been talked about to death in the last week or so, has certain issues with its implementation. But, that is not a borderline case. That was obviously a handball, and Decore must have known that he'd handled it. So if you make it incumbent on players who've done that to say to the ref, actually... Sorry, I handled it. Don't give a goal. And if you don't do that, you get a 2-game ban.
Well, let's make it 10.
Well, however, a number, whatever. then maybe you do iron out a lot of the obvious mistakes. Who was the one the other week? The obvious handball when he was offside as well.
Callum Wilson.
Yes, it was Callum Wilson. Yeah, the same thing. He must have known he'd handled that. I think Callum Wilson was actually probably more of a deliberate handball. I think Decore, he sort of misses it with his head and his hands there, and it's sort of an instinctive thing.
The only problem with that is, I'm largely in agreement with you, is that Watford still get the goal, Southampton still drop 2 points they should have had, and it's, you know...
Yeah, the argument is then Decore misses games that actually Southampton want Watford to win because they're playing against people that
down. If the punishment were significant enough, so 2 games, 3 games, 4 games, whatever, then you would begin to change the culture.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately what punishment is about, right? That's the whole point of punishment, is to change the sort of culture around it. And so if it became a culture, as in snooker, that you or golf, that you always declare fouls or whatever against yourself, then, I mean, yeah, it's a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. Yeah.
But I always think that's harsh when you don't sign the right scorecard and that's it. You're out of the US Masters. That seems like a bit harsh, doesn't it? You know, you just come in after a long day and out there for hours. You get bored by the 12th hole, don't you? And then suddenly you just sign the wrong thing and you've lost.
But I mean, how many people is that actually affected?
It's a very good point.
What's his name? The Argentinian in the Masters in...
Cabrera?
No, way back in the 60s.
I'm out of Argentinian golfers.
He got disqualified for that, but I don't think there's anybody else. Scott Murray would know.
I think...
Harrington got done on was... he did when he was addressing a putt. The ball had moved, and it was seen by somebody watching on TV, and he just hadn't noticed this kind of fractional movement, and so he should have declared a penalty against himself. And because he didn't, and then signed a scorecard, he was disqualified. Whereas DiVincenzo, is the golfer from the '60s, just signed whoever has been filling in his cards filled in the wrong number for the hole, and he just didn't notice and signed it.
I think the golf officials have stopped acting on the input.
Yeah, they
and
have,
advice,
which is a good thing.
Armchair snitches.
Yeah.
But can you imagine if football did the same thing?
That's exactly how
oh my
just
God.
Check Twitter 5 minutes after any decision, and that's what should happen. Huddersfield 1, West Ham 4. 16 points from 36 since David Moyes took over. Arnautovic and Lanzini tearing Huddersfield apart. In the second half,
I mean, Arnautovic is completely reborn under David Moyes.
It's ridiculous.
We finally found the play David Moyes can motivate.
but Huddersfield for the first goal is just, it's unforgivable, isn't it?
There was a good analysis of this by, I think it was Frank Lampard on Match of the Day, though, where he said Huddersfield have been trying to do this all season, is play out from the back. And I think Chelsea caught them cold doing it. And obviously West Ham are watching, and they sort of laid traps to get on top of them as soon as they tried to play it and pressed them really well. I mean, just on Arnautovic and Lanzini and West Ham in general, I've got to say, I mean, I thought David Moyes was a terrible appointment for West Ham. I thought his time, and these guys will know this better than me, at Sunderland was absolutely horrific. One of the biggest car crashes of a managerial reign I've ever seen. And I thought it was a ridiculous appointment. But fair play to him. I think he's done a phenomenal job at West Ham, as Roy Hodgson has at Crystal Palace as well, which we may get onto. And I'm really curious about the both of them, because they've both had the job before the ones they've got. They both had shockers, basically. And I just wonder how much they've gone away and assessed their style of management and the way they approach things, because they both look revitalised. They've energised the teams they've done. And as Jonathan was saying, what Moyes has done with Arnautovic, I think, is brilliant. I mean, I couldn't imagine anyone less capable of energising and motivating a player like Arnautovic than David Moyes. And they've done a great job. And for David Moyes to be playing a fluent front two and getting it to work as he has really surprised me as well. So fair play to the pair of them, I think.
Yeah, you mentioned Roy. Palace beat Burnley 1-0 in a pretty tight game. When did Bakary Sakho get good? I mean, because he really looked excellent in that game. And I saw him come on a few weeks ago and thought, I might even be faster than him.
I think he's had long-term injury problems, though, hasn't he? I think that may be in the case. He might finally be over them. But, yeah, I mean, he's got everything, isn't he? He looks a real athlete.
And that volley that went just over. Mm. Yeah. I hit that.
Yeah.
Hit it too well, as the cliche goes.
On the subject of Burnley, Yankee Viking 98 says, off topic, on a recent Danish football podcast, former international Søren Andersen revealed that a teammate of his at Bristol City used to pick up earthworms he found on the training pitch and eat them. The teammate was Sean Dyche. Any corroboration?
Sounds like a thing Sean Dyche would do.
I
none of us
are aware of this.
No. Have you ever eaten an earthworm?
Is Sean Dyche a notoriously early riser?
I don't know, but it's a great image, isn't it? Just walking around the training pitch. Do you think he'd go up to slug? I mean, I think there's a difference.
I think slug's quite bitter, and also it's going to be crunchier because the shell, it's got like a carapace inside, doesn't it?
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
So hang on. Well, obviously a snail has a shell, but you're saying a slug itself?
It's an internal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So if you're going to eat a slug,
an earthworm, I imagine, it's like those jelly worms, right? It's just got a bit more protein.
Yeah.
A worm sounds like the kind of thing you might eat for a bet, but not...
Yeah, I've seen somebody eat them for a bet when I was at school. In fact, there was a book in the school library called How to Eat Fried Worms. let me Google this.
I do remember hearing a story about Ozzy Osbourne snorting a line of ants.
Oh, I've eaten an ant once. Quite a salty snack in Colombia.
You know, we've all eaten flies and stuff like that.
Children's book written by Thomas Rockwell, first published in 1973. The novel's plot involves a couple of students eating worms as part of a bet. It's been a frequent target of censors and appears in the American Library Association's list of most commonly challenged books in the United States. It was subsequently turned into a film.
I think you're right, Baz, about the Jonathan Wilson sabotage plot. But carry on, John.
One hell of a pod, this. Mm. Sorry.
Directed Eclectic. By Bob Dolman, whoever he is.
Anyway.
Came out in 1996.
Marvellous. In the Football League, Wolves didn't win. Hit the bar.
No, 2006. Sorry, I misread it. 2006. Okay. Sorry.
So just 1 year after that game between Oxford and Cambridge.
The golden age.
Who knew we had it so good then? Films about worms, foreign managers of Oxford United pacing out the football pitch. It's never been the same since.
Maybe he's looking for worms. Maybe I thought he was pacing out.
In the Football League, Wolves didn't win. They hit the bar, had two ruled out, but Barnsley held them to a goalless draw. Derby celebrated Gary Rowett's new contract with a 3-0 win at Birmingham. Vidra getting his 16th of the season for them. Birmingham aren't bottom of the championship, though, because, Barry, Sunderland are. You lost to Cardiff, who are third. You watched it. Did you have a nice time?
Not really. They are bottom, and I suspect that is where they will stay, because it was a shameful performance. They have improved slightly over or under Chris Coleman, who I'm not a huge fan of. I didn't think he was the right appointment, but then I think anyone who's prepared to do the job clearly has some sort of deficiency that means they shouldn't be considered for it in the first place. They've kept a few clean sheets under him. They've won, I think, one game, possibly two. No, one. One drawn one, I think. But they are going down.
They won away at Burton and they Forest. Won one at Forest, yeah. Mm.
They, no strikers. Lewis Grabban's gone back to Bournemouth. Couldn't get out of Sunderland fast enough. James Vaughan signed for Wigan. Grabban was the only player scoring any goals. I think he got 10 in a bad team. And their defence is a shambles. They don't have a decent goalkeeper. There's no real midfield. And I can't see them going any other way than down.
Yeah, I think this is actually the worst team in Sunderland's history. We've only spent one season before in the third flight. So one previous relegation season, which was 86-7. And that team had two European Cup winning left-backs in it. Plus people like Gary Owers, Gordon Armstrong, Eric Gates, Gary Bennett, who were there for two promotions. I can't believe any of this side. Although we do have one European Cup winning left back, which is quite weird. What we've got to avoid is signing Mass.
One is enough, isn't it?
Well, it's John O'Shea, so it's probably too many.
That is Chris Coleman. That was the last, the first football match he's been in charge of in Wales since he lost the Republic of Ireland. As the Wales manager, and that job has now gone to Ryan Giggs. Ram asks, Giggs for Wales, how on earth does someone with no experience and scant regard in the past for internationals ever get the job? Is that slightly harsh on
No, I
on
think it's
Ryan
completely
Giggs?
Fair.
Okay.
I think it's a bewildering appointment. I mean, he may turn out to be brilliant, but it seems to me an enormous gamble.
One thing I'd say in Ryan Giggs' defence, and I do agree, I think it's a strange appointment, and particularly because of how many friendlies he's missed as a player, is would I be right saying Gary Speed didn't have a lot of international...
Well, neither did Mark Hughes,
yeah,
to be
fair. And they both did good jobs. I'm not necessarily sure. I think internationally, I wonder if that's less important because you've got so little time, it's a motivational thing. But I do agree it's a bit of a...
No, I mean, that's a fair point, that international management is different to club management, yeah. But...
That's why we got Claude Lavoie and Irv Reyna.
Not this game again.
But also... You know, people might say, oh, it's just Wales, doesn't really matter. But Wales have Gareth Bale at the moment. They're not going to have another Gareth Bale anytime soon, possibly ever again. It's a huge gamble to take when you've got a player of his ability in the team. Also, I think they are going to offer Giggs a 4-year contract, mm-hmm. which just seems extraordinary. I can't see the need for that. Give him 2. You know, see how he gets on. And producer Jonathan said, and I wasn't aware of this, that it won't be a popular appointment with Wales fans because a lot of them don't like Giggs because of his rather cavalier regard towards turning out for Wales when he was a player, because, you know, never playing friendlies, often not turning up for international duty. Compare that to Bale, who... never misses a game, whether he's injured or not. You know, he goes, stays with the team, goes to the games. And I find it a strange appointment. Similar thing to the talk of Phil Neville getting the job as the England women's manager. And
that rumour is because he started following every England women's footballer on
social and apparently media. It was suggested first as a joke, and a joke which was taken seriously by the FA. And, you know, again, he may be very good, but he's got no managerial experience and no notable interest in women's football. But, you know, we'll see. He hasn't got it yet, but he might.
Paul Scholes rumoured to be in for the assistant Wales job.
That's true.
Ryan Giggs, so I'm told. I mean, producer Jonathan could say anything in my ears and I'll read it out. I'm just a performing
that
monkey.
That is ridiculous. What's Scholes' assistant?
Yeah.
That's mental. It's just basically the class of 92, just sort of pitching up at in Cardiff.
With the joke,
Mickey Butt will be involved as well, won't he?
The joke doing the rounds is who will manage Wales for the friendlies. Yeah. So presumably whoever played left midfield for Wales when Giggs wasn't there. Johnny Robinson? Was he Welsh?
I don't remember.
Someone like that.
Just on the Giggs-Bale thing, I think that's a really good point Barry makes. Again, just to give Giggs possibly a little, not credit, but... What may work in his favour is having sort of been the Gareth Bale of his generation. Could he perhaps help Bale's development in any way? Perhaps just get a few pointers on the training ground? I mean, I'm clutching at straws, I know, but that might work
in his favour. I'm not sure Bale needs much help with his development at the moment. You know. Just needs help to stay fit.
Oh, yeah. John Robinson, Wales, played 30 times for Wales between 95 and 2002. So, yeah, Johnny Robinson, who I remember from Dream Team, when Harchester were losing to Charlton Athletic and the manager came into the dressing room and shouted, "I told you, Johnny Robinson, danger man, Clive Mendonca, danger man."
But speaking of Sunderland nightmares. Of
In League One, neither of the top two won. Wigan were held by Peterborough. Shrewsbury lost away at Blackburn, who are now third. The bottom side, Bury, have sacked their manager, Chris Lucchetti, after 2 months and 10 games in charge. They're bottom, haven't won a league game since he got the job, and they're 12 points from safety in League Two.
Just in League One as well, there was AFC Wimbledon travel to MK Dons, which I know Paul Doyle was at the game, but I really hope that the visiting Wimbledon fans sang that old classic, "Where were you when you were us?"
Yeah, they did. It was in the Observer, they made a mention of that. Can I make another just quick Football League related point?
Of course.
Just something that's obsessed me this weekend. There's this phenomenal image doing the rounds of Swindon. I don't know who Swindon Town played, but their bench at the weekend. And there's an image, you'll see it. I think it's doing sort of a lot of traffic on social media. There's a coach sat on the bench, and it looks like he's got a massive head and two faces. and it's really freaky and really disturbing and it's kind of queasy looking. When you actually analyse it properly, you realise what it actually is. I won't spoil it for anyone because it's a bit of a challenge. It's sort of a magic eye trick, but it's really worth checking out. It's a crazy, crazy image.
In League Two, leaders Luton lost 2-0 at Chesterfield. Meanwhile, Cambridge United and Mansfield shared the spoils in an uneventful goalless draw in League Two.
Oh, I dream of one of them.
One line of fit bar, 4-4-4. Albion Rovers 2. Shame. We'll be back with part three in a sec. Welcome to part three of Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous, thanks. So would you like to start with Real Madrid's defeat or Barcelona's comeback?
Let's start with Barcelona's comeback, shall we? Only because this is quite a big deal. Pep Guardiola, Tata Martino, Tito Villanova and Luis Enrique. I was looking this earlier, I worked it out. They've won 25 titles between them, those four managers, although admittedly, including Tata Martino in a list of titles won is perhaps a little bit of a push. But anyway, they've won 25 titles between them, including six league titles, five Copa del Rey, I think it is, and three European Cups, but never a league game at Anoeta. This weekend, Barcelona finally did that. It was quite a nice moment after the game when Valverde, Barcelona are 2-0 down, it's absolutely pouring with rain, and Ernesto Valverde is basically asked, you must have thought, here we go again. He said, yeah, exactly. But then Barcelona get one just before half-time with Paulinho, which is made by Luis Suarez. They get three more in the second half to win 4-2. The first time they've won there for a decade, 11 years in fact, and it basically puts the league title to bed, at least as far as Real Madrid are concerned, because I think perhaps it'd be a little bit unwise, even though it's a 9-point lead, to completely rule out Atletico.
Luis Suarez's goal was just glorious, wasn't it?
Well, I thought they were both pretty good, but yeah, the one that he scored, the curler into the far corner, because I think the thing about that makes it so good, in my opinion anyway, is the absolute deliberateness of it. Now, I know the immense majority of professional footballers do things that are deliberate. They are trying to score goals, but quite often, for example, when you see a long shot, it's, you know, they just hit it really, really well. But you see, as the ball's coming into him, he moves and he kind of runs right round the ball, takes a really, really long route round to kind of lift it and curl it into the far corner. It's a completely brilliant goal. A few people on Twitter suggesting he was trying to cross it, which suggests that they've never, ever seen Luis Suarez play.
Yeah, or never seen a football match. And it's baffling, isn't it? As you say, Real Madrid are now closer to the relegation zone than they are to Barcelona, losing at home to Villarreal. Well, another lovely finish, actually, from Pablo Fornals.
Yeah, very nice finish from Fornals, dinked over Keylor Navas. It was a kind of a touch of the Betis game again in this one as well. That against Betis early in the season, Madrid are pushing for the goal. It's 0-0. They get caught. Betis go up the other end and win it 1-0 late on. That's what happened in this. And afterwards, Zidane was talking about this. It's impossible to explain. And both of the big sports papers in Madrid ran on that the following day. And I think the title on the front of Marca was inexplicable, and the cover of Marca, I think, was no goals, no luck, no explanation. But I must admit, I think if this happens once, there is no explanation. If it happens more than once, if it keeps happening all season, if you keep dropping points, I don't think you can hide behind the luck argument, and I don't think you can hide behind this is unexplained. And I would like to think that Zidane's analysis privately at least is much more profound than this. You know, and if you're missing chances, that's not just bad luck, that's misses. That's getting things wrong. And I think that Madrid, their performances have been much better than their results this year. I think that's true. They haven't always been great. And they're such a long way down now that you know, the numbers are just overwhelming. Now, this is a team that's now, as you say, you know, closer to relegation than they are to the top of the table. 19 points behind Barcelona. Asterisk alert here. There's a game in hand, but still 19 points behind. And not only that, Tony Kroos said after the game, and I think he's probably right, our objective now has to be in qualification for the Champions League.
Is Zidane's job safe?
I mean, I think everything depends on the Champions League, on what happens against Paris Saint-Germain and on the Copa del Rey. Zidane is a very difficult man to sack because of the significance that he has, because of everything that he's achieved, because what he did last year is extraordinary. You know, you can argue to what extent it's his success, to what extent it's the success of the club, but what he has done as manager is absolutely incredible. Of course, everything he represents as a player as well means that he's not a manager that you sack lightly, which in truth, Rafa Benitez was. It was very, very easy to sack Rafa Benitez, to not even offer an explanation, to not say anything about it, and no one gave a flying monkeys. I think with Zidane, it'd be very different. So I don't think he's about to get sacked. But of course, the nature of Real Madrid means that if this collapse was to get worse. Because, you know, in this situation, anyone else would have been sacked already.
Kevin Gamero scored the only goal of the game. Sorry, Baz, did you want to say something?
No, I was just going to say it could be affected by the fact they can no longer give it Giggsy till the end of the season because he's just taken the Wales job.
Yeah, that's a big issue because I think you know, it was for Giggs, it was basically either Real Madrid or Wales, wasn't it? There was nothing else big enough for him.
I think so. Kevin Gamero scored the only goal of the game as Atletico beat Eibar. Some of the papers this morning here linking him with a £25 million move to Swansea. Why would anybody do that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not claiming to know whether or not this is true in the sense of, you know, I'm not claiming at this stage, what are we, 1 o'clock on a Monday afternoon to have spoken to anyone about this or to be able to stand this up. But as you say, yeah, my reaction is exactly the same as yours. On the face of it, why on earth would he do that? Now, he wants to play, and of course he's got a World Cup coming up and he'll probably want the minutes, but I'd be very surprised. I mean, while the money in the Premier League is very good and while clubs can offer the kind of fees, even you know, the clubs at the bottom half of the table can offer the kind of fees that most Spanish clubs can't, and probably the same is true even of Italian and French clubs as well. But it just doesn't make sense, does it?
No. And Sevilla now 5 without a win. All gone wrong, yep, after they sacked their manager, Barrizo, who was battling cancer. There was that story where he announced it at half-time, although he'd actually done it the day before the game, hadn't he?
Mm, he'd done it before, yeah. And since they sacked him, they've been beaten by Betis in a derby for the first time, I think, in 8 derbies they've not been beaten in. Now they've been beaten by Alaves out of the relegation zone as well, so it's quite a big deal for them. It doesn't look good for Sevilla, and Montella is under pressure already.
Sid, how did that decision to sack him go down in Spain? I could imagine there'd be all sorts of a palaver if an English Premier League team sacked a manager who was that ill.
Yeah, it wasn't actually treated. I mean, it didn't create quite such a stir as it might have done. I think in part because it's in the build-up to Christmas, and obviously with a winter break, there's a kind of momentary disengaging in Spain, and sort of it kind of gets forgotten a little bit. I think also there was a recognition, and this is going to sound horrible to say so, but there was a recognition that while Sevilla's position in the league wasn't bad, while they got through in the Champions League, while of course they'd had that game against Liverpool where they'd come back, there was a sense that actually they weren't very good, and that the job being done wasn't brilliant. I think there were a lot of people who thought, this really, you know, this doesn't feel right, and it's kind of unpleasant and uncomfortable. But it didn't create a huge stir. I think the other thing as well is to kind of put this in the context of Spain. Things that happen at Madrid and Barcelona create a huge stir. But things that happen elsewhere kind of largely don't, to be honest.
Finally, Sid, someone below the line, Rastavarian 8, says, long ball merchant sounds better in Spanish as comerciante de pelota larga. Is that actually... please tell me that is a phrase.
No, not. It's a great translation. I mean, he's literally, no. There is a nice phrase for it, though, which is Javier Clemente, the former Spain manager some time ago now, always described it as patapum pariba, which basically means bish bosh, get it up there. He used to describe it as that.
Oh, can you say that one
more
time?
I suppose it's like him being a Basque version of Peter Kay. And it's like saying avit. That was how he described it. Patapum pariba.
Oh, that's beautiful. Cheers, Sid.
My pleasure.
Top man Sid Lowe out in Spain. Will says, I think refs should always be allowed to kick players. Would add a little excitement to them, a bit like rollerball. And Caven says, would the pod like to see English refs take swipes at players? I'd personally love to see Bobby Madley drop his sizeable nut onto unsuspecting box-to-box midfielders. This is with reference to a quite extraordinary clip from Ligue 1. French referee Tony Chaperon got accidentally tripped by Nantes defender Diego Carlos. And he's on the floor. He spins round and tries to kick him. He then books Carlos, gives him a second yellow, and gives PSG a free kick. All in all, marvellous.
Yeah, it's a great clip. I saw it yesterday. And it was very, for me, reminiscent of David Beckham's kick out at Diego Simeone in France 98, I thought. And it's just mad to think what was going through his head at the time. Because even if he thought the player had deliberately kicked him, which he hadn't, why would he then kick him back?
Thought that, why is it yellow, not a red?
Yeah, exactly.
And the referee is technically, for the purposes of the game, part of the pitch. So that's like booking someone for running into a goalpost.
booking a bit of grass.
I would just like to see Mike Dean with his sort of no-look little sneaky stands on people's feet.
We had a ref in a friendly who once, mid-game, because it was getting a bit tetchy, turned to our centre midfielder and said, I don't care, you and me, let's go. And then he just, you know, just basically started on our centre midfielder. And actually, it was a moment of tactical brilliance because it had been quite a snipey game. And from then on, everyone was so terrified the ref was going to beat the living daylights out of them that we all behaved ourselves. I mentioned this on Twitter yesterday. Matt sent a tweet going, at full time, we once had a ref throw his cards and whistle on the dressing room floor and declared he wasn't the ref now and squared up to one of the players. So, you know, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Anyway, amazing. Serie A is on its winter break. That's back the weekend after next. Paolo will be on next Thursday, so he can tell us all about it. The Bundesliga came back from their rest this weekend. Bayern won again, 15 wins in 17 competitive games since Jupp Heynckes came back. They beat Bayer Leverkusen 3-1, including a beautiful free kick from James Rodriguez. It just doesn't even try and just bends it into the top left-hand corner. Dortmund were held to a goalless draw by Wolfsburg. 17-year-old Jadon Sancho made his full debut. Aubameyang was left out of the squad for missing an important team meeting. Looks like he could be on his way out to Arsenal. Would that be a good thing, Jonathan?
I mean, yeah, in the sense that I think he's probably better than Arsenal's level at the moment. He's obviously not the easiest person to deal with. But, you know, until this season, he was regarded as one of the top four or five strikers in Europe, and you know he's quick, he's strong, he scores goals. So yeah, I can see why, and Arsenal would do very well to get him. But equally, there's a reason why they might get him, and that's because he's obviously not easy.
And they could possibly blunt him quite quickly. First win in five for RB Leipzig as they beat Schalke.
I watched that actually.
Good game.
I had to watch it for a Korean magazine because it was on at the same time as Tottenham Everton, which I would otherwise have watched. But first half was pretty tepid, and then second half, once Wagner came off the bench, Leipzig looked a bit more like they had, because they had a very dodgy run through December, but they looked a bit more like they had in the early part of the season. And it was the first time they've played 4-3-3 rather than 4-4-2 since they went up, certainly this season, which is what Hasenhüttl did at Ingolstadt, but he used the 4-4-2 that Rangnick had used. So whether that's something they're going to do more in the future. And Sabitzer was back, and his pace clearly makes a big difference to them on the right.
Sorry, the most interesting part of that anecdote, which you failed to elaborate on, was Korean magazine.
Yeah, it's a globalised marketplace these days, Barry. You've got to take the opportunities where they are.
Okay.
Yeah, the Korean magazine asked me to write a piece on that game, so I did.
Mm. Is that a regular thing?
Well, it was, and then it sort of went to abeyance, and now it seems to have come back, so...
When's the piece out?
Oh, I don't know. It's a Korean FA's...
North or south?
Just about to ask.
South. It's the South Korean FA's official magazine, Onside, which I believe is a monthly.
Okay. Keep an eye out.
Yeah, I mean, it's in Korean, so I have to say I struggle to understand.
How do you know you're not being misquoted?
I have no idea. I mean...
He doesn't care as long as he gets paid.
Köln won their second game in a row. This after going winless in 16. Now still 8 points from safety. Feedback corner. Then don't worry, we're done, Jonathan. More on double-barreled named footballers. Daniel says, this is a worldie of a double barrel. Landed Gentry in the 1800s. He's referring to Manchester City youngster set to join Oxford on trial, Isaac Buckley-Ricketts. Tom writes, I thought you'd like to know that last week when you said Alex Iwobi on the pod, you made my Amazon Alexa play Moby. Matt Simpkins says, they mentioned frozen doner kebabs on Football Weekly, so naturally I had to get one to see if they're as gross as they sound. He sent an accompanying picture made by a company called Big Shack, to which Paul Compton replied, Chris Kirkland introduced these to me 20 years ago. To which Chris Kirkland replied, introduced you to what? So as yet no official confirmation if Chris Kirkland is the best professional footballer who dined on frozen doner kebabs, but hopefully we'll get some confirmation on that. And finally, Pink Mouse said, it's a good thing Nottingham Forest didn't beat Fulham in the cup, otherwise Eric Leachai would have to have named his dog Cottager. Not something you want to be shouting when you're wandering through the woods. Thanks for your time, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Sachin.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers.
And we'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.